Welcome back to episode 38 of the Groups Matter podcast show. This is Brian Daniel, and I am here with Chris Surratt.
What's going on?
Lots of stuff. So we got the Super Bowl behind us, apparently.
That was an exciting game.
And I retracted my post that declaring winter officially over. It was later in January, though. I mean, we had a few sunny days. I figured, why not? Let's give it a shot.
When we get sunny days in Nashville in the winter, it's like it's a tease because we know that the clouds are coming back, possible snow, some more cold. So it's just like they're teasing us. I was just in Phoenix, Arizona, and they have sun 365 days a year. That's what it should be.
Well, it's not a tease for me, the eternal optimist. I usually, if you have a 60-degree day in January, it's over. We're turning the corner. We're declaring this thing over. Mm-hmm. And yes, it does feel premature, but it also feels good and right.
If it helps you get off to a better start in your day, whatever it takes.
Hang
those coats up. Put the heavy clothes in the closet and have a better attitude.
That's right. It's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy.
That's all it takes.
All right. So episode 38. Good to be back with you, Chris.
It's good to be with you as well.
And we have a guest, Alan White, who is the author of more than one book, but most recently Exponential Groups: Unleashing Your Church's Potential. Now it's going to be calling us here in just a few minutes. And you've known Alan quite a while, right?
I've known Alan for quite a while. We lived in the same town for a while, and I lived in Greenville, South Carolina, which is where Alan bases out of as well. And so a great small groups thinker and strategist, and actually had a chance to endorse the book. So I read it about a month ago, and it's a great book, and can't wait to talk to Alan a little bit more about it.
Now, Alan has been in circulating in small group circles for a while now. How long have you known him?
I've known Alan for probably the last, I would say, 12 to 15 years. At the time, he was at a church in Greenville called Brookwood Church, which is a very large church. And then before that, he was in Southern California, I'm sure he'll talk about. And he's also been involved with Life Together Ministries with Brett Eastman, and has just kind of done ministry all over America, helping churches launch campaigns with small groups and build their small group systems. And the guy just has a bank of knowledge, and I can't wait to talk to him.
Now, Alan is a guy that he can talk about Bible study curriculum. He can talk small group strategy and structure. He can talk about church leadership. He's one of those guys that really, would you say he has a specialty or a niche, or would you say he is the generalist of generalists in terms of small group?
I would say that he's a generalist, but one of his niches is that campaign idea, mm-hmm. that kind of launching a lot of groups at the same time, which is, I think, speaks to the title of his book, Exponential Groups, which we'll ask him about. But I think that's really kind of where his specialty is, because he has done a lot of campaigns with extremely successful churches and launched thousands of groups through campaigns. But he's also, I think he was a lead pastor for a little while at a church he was at, which is a unique story for him. So, yeah, I think he sees the broad picture as well.
Well, we're looking forward to having Alan on the show. And given that we're almost to 40 episodes, I'm surprised we haven't had him on yet. So it's going to be nice. Before we got there, before we come into these sessions, Chris and I will, we're readers, but a lot of times we will highlight certain blog posts that we found in the interim. So this article is by Michael Kelly, and Michael's been on the show at least once, but I think he's been one of with us twice, maybe even three times. This is at factsandtrends.net, and it's about culture. And the title is Laying the Cultural Foundations of Your Church. And Michael talks in terms of rebar, that culture, and really he's elevating the importance of culture. He says an organization's culture, especially in a church, is like rebar. Culture is core to who we are and shapes everything we do. It is the summation of what we value, what we believe, and what makes us unique as a church. And he goes on to say, the small group is one of the easiest windows into where the culture of the church is truly understood and embraced by the people. So how would you react to that statement?
I think he's dead on with that. And I think when it comes to the small group world, culture is where we miss it so often. I think a lot of times we look at, if you look at the three C's, we look at competence, you know, are they a leader? Can they lead a group? Can they lead a group of people? So if they've got that, we're great. And then we look at kind of the chemistry, you know, can they get along with people? Because if they don't get along with people, they're not going to have a very successful small group. They're going to come and not stay or not come back. But then we kind of skip over that culture piece. And when you have a leader who's competent and has chemistry, but doesn't get the culture of the church, that small group can go wrong really quickly. And so I think it's on us as small group point people to kind of instill that culture of the church, that DNA of the church, into those small group leaders as they lead their small groups. Because what we're doing is we're creating these kind of mini churches within our church. And if we're just kind of throwing them out there without any rebar, without kind of that framework, you know, they're going to pick their own culture and they're going to pick their own framework. And that may be completely off from where we want to go as a church. And I think that scares a lot of pastors. And some pastors are afraid to start small groups that maybe meet off campus because they're afraid that where can they go, you know? And it goes back to, you got to lay that right foundation. You got to instill that culture into those groups so they're going the same direction as a church.
And on the other side of that, you've got your small group ministry as an indicator of culture. Mm-hmm. It had an examination of your groups and what they value and maybe how they engage the ministries of the church or the community. I think that is probably the clearest indicator of whether what your culture is and what your vision and values and how they're taking hold.
Mm-hmm.
So a robust small group ministry has a lot of ministry application, or a lot of ministry application. But one of those, I guess you would call it a latent benefit or indicator, is this idea of culture and how it indicates just how successful you are at articulating your values.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The groups tend to be kind of the first touch to the community because they're out there. And hopefully if you have small groups, they're serving in the community and that's a part of who they are. And so that's who the community sees when they think of your church. They will think of the people that they interact with. And a lot of times that's small groups. And so what kind of culture is that bringing? And is it affecting the culture around them? You know, we talk about a lot that small groups should be out into the culture and affecting it. And what are they bringing to it? And whatever you're instilling in them as a church and as leadership, that's what they're taking into the community.
So Michael gives us three windows here. And the first one is articulate your culture. The second is define the when. And the third is feed the people. So to the first one, articulate your culture. Culture is hard to pin down, Michael says, but it's important to be able to say in a few words who you are as a church. It's unfair to expect yourself or others to operate according to a culture that hasn't been defined. So this idea of defining your culture is paramount. Just as rebar must be solidly tied and framed, he says, we must also be able to put words around who we are as a church and what God has called us to do. It's the importance of words as much as anything.
It is, and I think that speaks a lot to what your mission is. What is your mission statement as a church? And I talked to so many churches that they're unclear on what their mission statement is, and their people are unclear on what it is because it doesn't seem important, but it is important. That's what you give your leaders to kind of sell your church to their friends, their neighbors, their small group. And, you know, so in that one statement, does it intrigue them enough to want to know more? So can you say who your church is and what you're about and how you're going to accomplish what your mission is in that one statement and cause somebody who doesn't know your church to go, that's interesting. I want to know more about that.
And then he says you need to define the when, which there's a fine line here between articulating vision, I think, and defining the when. I think a lot of times that we articulate vision, that's when language becomes action, and too often we leave it at language. We need to know, so what is a win here? How will we know when we arrive at any given destination?
And I think that small groups, specifically in the churches, is where we don't articulate the win very well. It's kind of easier in other ministries, like your kids ministry, your student ministry. You know, you have attendance and you have all these things every week that you can say we're winning. But when it comes to small groups, how are we winning and what does that look like? And are we celebrating those wins? I think we miss that so many times with small groups.
Yeah, you cultivate what you celebrate.
Yep.
Michael goes on to say, is the primary, this is what he asked to that, is the primary purpose prayer? teaching, intimacy, and relationships? Depending on how you answer that question, the leader will know what must be done weekly and what can be done weekly.
And I think that goes back to what is the vision of the pastor? Because you have to tap into where your senior pastor, your senior leader, the senior visionary, where does his heart lean? Because pastors will lean different ways. They will, you know, a lot of times they'll lean more towards community. So they want you to build community, or they want to lean more towards theology. And so you want to lean that way, but just find out where your pastor is. And that's going to direct, where you teach your small group leaders to go with their groups.
And then talking about culture and how small groups, facilitate and indicate culture within a church. The last one is feed the people. And Chris, interesting that this would need to be, that Michael would feel like this needs to be stated.
It is, and, you know, I stand in this soapbox a lot, and so listeners may be a little tired of it, but Michael said it, so I'll repeat it. But I think if we're not giving our leaders, if we're not giving them good content, if we're not teaching them how to facilitate a discussion around the Bible, we're not feeding our people. We're not feeding the people in our groups, in our churches. And if you're thinking about, again, back to that culture, if you're thinking about these being many churches within your church, you can't just let them hang out there. You have to feed them. You have to help them grow spiritually. So, you know, look at how are you feeding your people? How are you feeding your small group leaders who will end up feeding the people in their care?
Michael says, as much as we may hate to admit it as church leaders, the small group environment has an even greater impact than the large group worship time, because in these pockets of community, talking about the small group, anonymity is impossible. And I would go even one step further to that and say, this is the opportunity to be known. So it's not just that you can just sit and be passive. It's also an opportunity to be known and to participate in the culture and to be invited into culture at that one-on-one level. So that's Michael Kelly. Although this particular article was, we found this at factsandtrends.net. You can follow Michael at michaelkelly.com. That's M-I-C-H-E-E-L-K-E-L-L-E-Y. So common spelling, that last name is K-E-L-L-E-Y. So I encourage you to check out Michael. The blog is called Forward Progress, and there's some really good content out there. He is one of the experts in discipleship, I would say, at Lifeway.
I would say he is about as much of an expert as you're going to find.
Yep. He has that bottom line responsibility. So he's a friend of the show, been with us a few times, so I'd encourage you to check out that blog. So I think we've got Alan on the line. Let's see if we can see what Alan's got to say.
Well, hey, Alan, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, great to be here.
We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us a little bit. Just some background about Alan while he's on the phone here. Alan, he coaches churches in launching exponential groups all over the country. He's been doing this for like 25 years and has served on staff at two churches, New Life Christian Center in California and Brookwood Church in Simpsonville, South Carolina, where I got to know Alan, and as well as coaching over 1,500 churches across North America.
Wow.
And he leads workshops and all kinds of stuff for people like Small Group Network out of Saddleback, and has some degrees and lots of stuff like that. So this guy's an expert, and I'm excited to have you.
Alan, great.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, Alan, great to have. We were just talking before you got on the line that we can't believe we've done, now this is our 38th episode, and we have not had you on yet. So thank you for being with the Groups Matter show. This is a good time. You are one of the, I guess I will say it, you're one of the legacy small group guys through this whole movement over the last quarter century or so. So we are honored that you would be our guest today. And it looks like you have a book that has just released, Exponential Groups, Unleashing Your Church's Potential. So we'll talk. Let's just start there. So when you talk about exponential groups, what makes groups exponential?
It's a very good question. Thanks for having me. I don't know about being called an expert, because I'm still trying to figure things out, and I always get new puzzles along the way. But to me, exponential is this. You know, we used to think it was a really big deal when you had 30 to 50% of your people connected in groups. And then we thought it was a really big deal when you had over 100% connected in groups. And, you know, we all kind of were on that bandwagon for a while. But, I really came to terms with was, it was one thing, you know, our church in California, we actually got to a place where we had 125% in groups. But the number that mattered more to me as I look back is that we went from having 30% of our adults in groups to having nearly 40% of our adults lead a group for at least 1 6-week study. So to get to 125% in groups, we had 13% of our adults leading. And so that really began to make me think, because it's one thing to increase your groups by 10% because you do a campaign or something, you recruit a bunch of leaders, you get a bunch of groups started. It's another thing to for your groups to go 10 times where you're currently, you know, with leaders. And so just, you know, a couple of quick examples, working with a church in Baltimore, it's a church of 600 adults, and they just launched a new series with their pastors teaching on video. They started 147 groups in the church of 600. And, you know, I've had churches over the years, churches of 2,500 that have 500 groups, one church of 4,000 adults, recruited 1,200 leaders in a day, which is 30% of their congregation. So that's really where I'm getting to. Exponential is not how many people can we connect in groups, but rather how many of our people can gather a circle of friends and lead a group.
That's good, Alan. In the first sentence of the book, and by the way, I love the book. I actually got to read it about a month ago. I guess Alan sent it to me, and I had a chance to endorse it. And it's an amazing book. But you say everyone is already in a group. Now, how did you come to that conclusion? And what if they're not actually in a group?
Yeah, it's almost that thing of everybody's in a group except they're not. That's what we say in the South. No, where I came to the conclusion was this. We at our church in California, I really wanted to build a compelling case for why people should join groups that will help them to grow more, help them to connect more, serve more. You know, the fast track to spiritual growth was being in the small group. And if you're not in the small group, then, you know, what are you doing? You're just playing around. And so we sent out a survey to our congregation, and it was a health assessment. And we asked them to rate themselves. And what we discovered was that the people that were in groups rated themselves exactly the same as the people that weren't in groups. And especially in the area of fellowship and connection and that sort of thing, I was a little beside myself in that these people that were not in groups regarded themselves as being connected. So I went back and sent another survey because I had to figure this out. Maybe they misunderstood the question. And so I said, what other believers are you connected to on a regular basis? And they said, well, friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, customers. And a light bulb kind of went off in my head where I thought, you know what? These people have families, friends, neighbors, you know, coworkers. And so essentially they are in groups. And so all I need to do is give them a Bible study, draw a circle around them, and call them a group. And so that's where I arrived there. Now, there are always exceptions. Probably one of the most valuable pieces of advice I ever received from a friend of mine named Brett Eastman out of Life Together Ministries. He said, let the exceptions be the exceptions. So there are people who are new to town. There are people that are new to the church, and they want to make friends with the church, or they're new in the community. They literally don't know anybody. So then, you know, you make some adjustments and some suggestions or, you know, for them there. But to me, the big part of it is that if people will look at their existing relationships and they'll leverage their existing relationships, not only will it help form better groups, it also encourages people to get involved. Because a lot of times we say, join a small group, and the excuse is, I don't have time. But we say, well, why don't you get together with your friends and do a study? Well, they can find some time for that. And there's almost a sociological thing there where by joining a small group, somehow we're volunteering to spend less time with our friends. So what if we just did something intentional about our spiritual growth with the people who are already in our lives and not make it this weird thing of I filled out a sign-up card and they assigned me to somebody's group and I don't know who they are and I get there and all the people seem strange to me. And, you know, instead of going through all that awkwardness hoping that something good would come out of it, you know, it's almost like we, you know, go with the sure thing in that we have people connect with people that they already know and they do the Bible study that way. So in that vein, everybody's already in a group.
Yeah, I agree. I love how Rick Warren talks about if you have two or three friends, you can host a group. You can have a group. I mean, that's really, it's, you know, if you get down to it, that's as simple as it is, which really kind of makes you focus on the content that you're giving them. So, you know, that kind of leads to my next question is, you know, you talk some about launching groups through church-wide campaigns. And I love campaigns. Mm-hmm. I talk about campaigns a lot. I've written about campaigns. And, you know, you put a lot of effort into kind of the content that you give, you know, these hosts and leaders because you want it to be simple enough for them to follow. And a lot of churches, you know, shoot their own videos and things like that. And they put a lot of effort. But then, you know, what I hear a lot from churches, you know, I've talked to several churches lately that say, we tried the campaign. And it just, you know, it was great for the moment, but then it just kind of went away and it failed. So what would you say, how do you keep that from happening? That once that 6 weeks is over, you know, you've got a ton of people in the groups, and then a lot of times, a lot of those groups just fall apart. How do you keep that from happening? What's a different approach to take?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. And the one is kind of what I was just talking about, is how you form the groups. And if you form the groups with people that already know each other, then the groups of friends tend to last longer than groups of strangers. So that's one thing. The second thing is coaching. And even if it's a matter of taking an experienced leader and saying, hey, here's a new person that's going to get together with the friends, do the study or host a group, whatever you want to call it. Would you walk alongside with them for the length of this, from when they say yes to the end of the study? Encourage them, answer their questions, give them some personal attention. And to me, you know, we went through a series where, you know, we had a lot of groups going and then we lost 30% of the groups. And what we discovered was out of the 30% that the majority of those had never started. And it led me to a very significant proverb that's in the book. And that is this, the groups that don't start tend to not continue. The coaching piece is there. People invite people. They get turned down, they get discouraged, they feel like, okay, I shouldn't have done this, this was a mistake. So I think the way you form groups, having somebody there to coach the group that cares enough to pick up the phone, and then the third thing is providing some sort of a next step. So in the middle of the current series or the current campaign, in the middle of that, you say, oh, by the way, if you enjoy meeting together, we're going to offer you another study that's going to begin right after this one. It doesn't have to be another campaign. But the idea is in the middle of it, you offer the next step. You want them to make the decision as to whether or not they're going to continue before the current study ends. And if you're kind of hitting on those three things, the way you form the groups, you coach the groups, give them that next step, you know, you should get 80% or better continuing. You know, there's always margin of error there. But, you know, I've seen even like groups we started after Easter, which I had three reasons I didn't want to launch groups after Easter, June, July, and August. And with these groups, the first week in May, we announced them, oh, by the way, our next study is going to be launching the second week in October. And here's some things that you could do during the summer, serving-wise, social-wise. And we got to the fall, and 80% of the groups that had started after Easter were right there ready to go in the fall. And I wouldn't have believed it, except I had experienced it myself. Mm. So that's kind of where I go. But if you do 6 weeks and you just expect them without an invitation, without any kind of motivation to continue, then the thing's going to fall off the cliff.
Thanks, Alan. Anytime that you get into a conversation about campaigns or exponential groups in this context, I think implied are questions about leadership and recruiting leaders. And I know when that comes up, that a lot of times that's where the conversation goes. I think no one disputes the merit of the campaigns, but I think with a lot of leaders and a lot of churches, it's like, well, where are these guys? It's hard enough just launching one or two groups, much less many more. So So my question is, as a follow-up, is some pastors tend to be very cautious about what they see as lowering the bar on leadership. I'm sure you've heard that. So how do you respond, or how would you respond to that kind of reaction?
Yeah, I've really gotten away from the language about lowering the bar. The one quote I'll still use is from Neil Cole, where he says, we need to lower the bar on what it means to be a leader and raise the bar on what it means to be a disciple. But I know in a lot of pastors' minds, when you use the term lower the bar, you feel like, okay, if you're breathing, you're qualified, and then how much of a problem is that going to create? So I go more the route, instead of saying, you know, eliminating requirements or lowering the bar, I talk about delaying requirements. So it's almost like maybe it's a terrible example, but when you go to buy a car, if you're going to buy a car, you have to fill out a lot of paperwork. You sign a lot of documentation for the state to get licensed. And if you're, you know, taking out a loan, I mean, there's a lot of paperwork to it. But usually in the process of buying a car, you don't start there. You start with a test drive. And the only thing that's required to take a test drive is that you have a driver's license. And so to me, a campaign or something like that, you can let people take a test drive. Most people don't regard themselves as being leaders. But if they can gather a group, you know, Steve Layden says if they're leaders, they have followers. So if they have followers, then they're leaders. And so I think for every church, we have to decide what is the driver's license for our test drive. And some churches, it's been breathing. Some churches, it's been, you know, understanding their spiritual background. Some churches, it's been membership. Some churches, it's been membership in an interview. And then, you know, whatever the church is comfortable, because you have to arrive at your own acceptable level of risk. And I talk about that in chapter 3 in the book. But you give people a test drive, you invite them to more, and then you say, oh, by the way, if you'd like to become an officially recognized group of our church, we have these requirements, and we have this process, and we offer this training to go through. And I don't make it mandatory. I mean, I live in a state that has no helmet law. We don't make anything mandatory. But I invite people to that. Otherwise, if you're too strong on it, you know, cat's out of the bag, then go buy a DVD and do a Bible study and not be any part of your system. They kind of go underground, and then you can't communicate with them. But I think the main thing is, you know, you waive some requirements temporarily to see how people do for 6 weeks. And if they want to continue, you know, an ongoing group, then you bring back some of the requirements. The other thing that I found is it's less risky if you don't advertise the groups. If they're inviting their friends, their neighbors, their coworkers, other people into the group, and you're not sending people to the group, you don't advertise that on the website or in a small group directory or anything else, that also takes a little bit of the risk factor out of that. And then, of course, you would have some groups that are the pillars of your church or people that are very well known that you would advertise. For those folks that don't get invited, and then there's a place to plug them into a group.
Yeah, I've seen that in launching campaigns and launching groups. And something else that I got from Steve Glayden is that the higher the bar you set, the more quality groups you're going to have. The lower the bar, the more quantity of groups you're going to have. And so you just kind of have to decide which side of the pendulum you wanted to swing, and then what the feedback's going to be after that. So that is so good. Finally,
yeah,
Alan.
These weren't things. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
These weren't things that, you know, came to me right out of the gate. These were things that it took a process. I mean, I go back to the early days, and some of the things I was hearing people doing to form groups scared me to death. And, you know, over a period of time, I began to arrive at things that, well, first of all, because I was in such a great deal of frustration. So I was handpicking all of our leaders. I was training them. I was coaching them. And if I didn't know you, you are not going to lead a group in my church. And we got stuck. We got stuck about 30% of our adults. And then I began to learn some other things about how to form groups in maybe ways that were a little less risky, or at least, you know, take a risk and you know, get a little further, because we weren't being very effective in how we were doing all of that. And so once we got to the place where, you know, we started opening this up, inviting people into leadership, giving them a coach, giving them training, you know, these sorts of things. But you know, initially not requiring as much. What I discovered was our main obstacle to growth in our groups was in my own thinking. And once I began to change my thinking, once I began to see how people that I never would have regarded as a leader could gather a group, could do a Bible study, and to see God using them, I really came to the thing of how many people in our congregation can we equip and empower to serve in this way, even if they never called themselves a small group leader. They were just getting together with their friends and doing a study.
That's good. One last question for you, Alan. And if you, as you step back, because you have worked with a ton of churches across the nation, probably more than nearly anyone, where do you see or where do you feel that churches are missing it the most with small groups?
Yeah, I think part of it is that we look at our congregations and we see a handful of people that we know. If they had a group, it would be its own brand of trouble. And we don't want to deal with that. And so sometimes because of that, then we'll withhold the invitation from a lot of people that we don't know that would do an amazing job. And what I discovered is the problems amount to about 2%. And that was about the same that Steve Gladden and before him, Brett Eastman, found at Saddleback, was the problems amounted to about 2% of the people. And then you just, you know, have pastoral conversations with those folks. The other thing I see is giving support and encouragement to your leaders. And every leader is not the same. I mean, if they're a new leader, you know, they need a lot more support. They need a lot more direction. If they've led for a while, they need to be cared for, but they don't need to be heavily supervised. And I think coaching has become so convoluted in some circles, people have given up on it, or they give out a phone, you know, a phone number. So you phone a friend if you get into trouble. But I still see coaching is built on a relationship. And I think if a church doesn't have a coaching structure, they're not working toward that. I think it's probably one of the biggest mistakes I'm seeing right now in small group ministry. But I think, you know, as other methods of discipleship are kind of falling by the wayside, or new churches are starting with a big weekend service and maybe they have a rented facility, you know, groups are very flexible. And the nice thing about groups is you don't have to build a lot of buildings to house them, to have classrooms. That most churches have hundreds of millions of dollars of property in the homes of their members, or in a Starbucks, or in a bookstore, or in, you know, a break room at work. We have a group that met on a commuter train. And so I think if we give our people, you know, permission, we give our people opportunity, they can become very highly creative in how groups are formed and what those groups look like. And we have a coach there, so we know that the group is doing okay and it's not doing something weird. We provide the curriculum for them, and especially if we do a video curriculum, then we know what's being taught because we've delivered the teaching to them. And I think beyond, you know, the curriculum and the coach, that's about as far as we can go in controlling anything related to groups. And yet we can offer enough flexibility that our groups can go a lot further than we ever imagined that they could.
Well, Alan, I really appreciate you being with us for episode 38 of Groups Matter. Again, this is Alan's book is now available, Exponential Groups, Unleashing Your Church's Potential. That's published by Hendrickson. And you can follow Alan at alanwhite.org. Alan, you probably have Twitter too, right?
I do, which is Alan White, two L's and an E.
Yeah, that's alenwhite.org. And then at the Twitter would be at Alan White. So again, appreciate you being with us. It's a good guest, Chris. Thanks for making that happen.
I love Alan's perspective and his history and knowledge. And really, I would encourage you to get the book because he obviously expands on what he just talked about. And it's good practical advice for any church who wants to launch small groups.
I would be interested in your take on that leadership question as it relates to the campaign and the bar on leadership. I had not heard that before. Lower the bar and you get a greater quantity. Raise the bar and you get greater quality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough decision to make. How have you navigated that in the past?
It is a tough decision. And I will say this, do not make the decision without your senior pastor's blessing on where it needs to be. Because when we decided basically the same as Alan. We needed to raise the percentage of people in groups, and we were at about 33%. And our goal was to be 80%. And we recognized that we were never going to get there if we didn't lower that bar. And so my first conversation was with my pastor, telling him what that meant, what that looked like, what the ramifications could be out of that. And I used some of those percentages, the 2% and all of that, that could go wrong. And so we did. And it really came true for us. We went from 33% to over 90% because we lowered the bar. But I also like that what Alan talked about, delay the requirements. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to put it, is, you know, you lower the bar for them to get into kind of hosting a group, but then you kind of, you coach them along and you train them as they go. And so they're kind of building those requirements that you're not putting in front of them at the beginning.
It seems like another approach would be taking the percentage approach, maybe perhaps a different direction would be, we're going to only have at any given time 20 to 30% of these new or riskier leaders, and not all at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know in a campaign situation if you can really avoid that, but then maybe in 6 months we do it again. So at no given time do you have a large contingency that way, and that way you can kind of limit your exposure.
Yeah, I think that's probably smart, and I like what Alan said about not advertising some of those groups. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing. We had kind of a level of host groups that had no requirement for advertising, and we just encouraged them, invite your friends, invite your neighbors. You know, we're not going to put it on the website. We're not going to push people toward your group, but we're going to give you content, and we're going to give you coaching. And I think that's a pretty safe way to do it.
This context for that question is really good, though. A good way to approach, because starting new groups is probably one of the more demanding things of group ministry, and how you do that, what are the wins, how many groups, where are you going to get those leaders. And so even just to think through with some measure of intention, how am I going to approach this qualification question, I think it's just healthy. Where you land, you know, prayerful counsel, and just make a good informed decision, and, you know, just know you're taking a chance at some level, regardless of what you do.
Yeah, not every church should launch a church-wide campaign with hosts and all of that. I mean, I do believe that's how you can start the most groups at the same time, but not every church is there yet and shouldn't do that yet, but it's something to think about. It's a strategy to maybe get, you know, to move toward, but you may not be there yet, and that's okay. But know, going back to that article that we read earlier, defining the win, know what the win is out of either your campaign or your launch or whatever it is. Just have the right expectations and then celebrate those.
Well, that was nice of Alan to give us time. I know he's real busy. Chris, before we wrap up episode 38, would you want to tell us a little bit about our sponsor, smallgroup.com?
Yeah, Alan teed it up for us, smallgroup.com. If you're going to do message-based studies, especially if you're doing a campaign, I built all of my campaigns at the church I was at with smallgroup.com because it's easy, it's quick, and it's biblically based. So check it out. 2-week trial. Go to smallgroup.com.
Thanks, Chris. I'm Brian Daniel with co-host Chris Surratt and producer Drew Porterfield. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time.